Welcome to episode 13 of the Skip to the End podcast. I'm Ben.
I'm Mark.
And I'm Adam.
And on this edition of the podcast, we're going to be reviewing Whiplash, the new Oscar-nominated thriller. Would you say it was a thriller? I found it thrilling.
Yeah.
So we'll say thriller, starring J.K. Simmons and Miles Teller. And Mark, what's the topic?
The topic is the best supporting act performance that's actually outshined the leading actors in any film.
Okay. And that, can that be men and women? Actors,
yeah, just performance? Both.
What? I'm going to bet now that none of us have got a woman between us.
No.
We'll soon find out. We're also doing a rewatch. The film we're rewatching this week is Aliens, sequel to Alien, surprisingly enough. And Adam, we've got a big new feature.
Yes, we do. We used to give out prizes on the podcast, so this week we're giving out awards.
Yeah.
So it's the first annual Skip to the End Awards. It's called The Skippies.
The Skippies.
So we've got some nominations we'll be reading out later alongside the winners.
Excellent, yes. And as ever, we'll be taking some listener questions toward the end of the show. So let's get started.
Boom.
So guys, this week's topic is to pick your top three supporting performances that you believed outshone the leading performance in a movie.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll start with my number three then. It's one we've kind of spoke about before, actually. It's Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
I think his performance as Sean Maguire outshone Matt Damon as Will Hunting.
Yeah.
And Matt Damon's performance as Will Hunting is a very good performance as well. But for me, Sean Maguire, Robin Williams, just knocks it out of the park completely.
Yeah, you'll get no argument from me. I think Damon is very, very good in it, but it's Williams' film.
He just owns it completely. It's not even a case of necessarily outshining. It's just, it makes you forget about Damon's performance. Mm-hmm. He's just that good.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally agree on that. It's an unbelievable performance. I think we've, obviously, unfortunately, when we discussed that Robin Williams had passed away, I think we all agreed it was one of his strongest performances
at that
ever.
Point, Ben actually hadn't seen it, had he?
Yeah.
That's where you got the homework from, and I think the week after you came back and said that although you didn't find the film particularly amazing, Williams just smashed it completely.
Yeah, the best dramatic performance of his I've seen. Yeah.
Oh, unbelievable performance. So, I mean, that's my number three, and I think it's probably a good place to start as far as supporting performances go.
Yeah. Well, my number three is Robert Carlyle as Begbie in Trainspotting.
Wow, that's a nice one.
Yeah.
Begbie is one of my all-time favourite characters. He's just hilarious. Like the scene when he just sort of starts his own fight by throwing the pint glass over the balcony behind him. And then when he realises it started to kick off, he just goes, yeah! So he can wade in. And, you know, the film, technically the lead of that film is Ewan McGregor as Renton. Yeah. And then you've got other somewhat lead characters as well, like Johnny Lee Miller as Sick Boy. But it's Begbie's film for me.
Kind of supporting characters in that, really.
Yeah.
As far as things go, like you say, there's several kind of leads as well. But no, I think Robert Carlyle puts in a fantastic performance in that.
He's so funny. And, you know, I could just sit here and quote a lot of his lines, but we'd have to bleep them all. Because most of them contain a word that begins with a C and ends with a T.
We're not allowed to use that one.
What?
I meant can't.
Oh, sorry, yeah. We don't use that word.
No, well, good choice. My third one is going to be Edward Norton in Fight Club.
I wouldn't say he was the supporting character.
He went down as the supporting character.
Is this a Sandman moment?
No, he is
class. He's got Sandman in his list. That's his number one, Sandman.
Don't ruin it, spoilers. He's still classed as a supporting actor in that movie. I did a lot of research, and yeah.
He's in every scene.
I know, but it's actually...
Brad Pitt, I think Brad Pitt was the one that actually went forward for best
actor, yeah.
That's odd decision on their part. They've clearly done that at the time because Pitt was the more famous man of the two. But that's arse about face because Norton is undoubtedly the lead in that
film. Well, yeah, like you said, he's in every scene and essentially Pitt can't be in a scene without him.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Given the major spoilers here, but given they're the same person.
Yeah.
So for me, his performance completely outshone Brad Pitt.
I think that's a bit of a loophole you've used there. Yeah. Fair enough.
It counts.
No, not really. No, I think that's a Sandman moment.
No, it is. Basically. Well, that was a Sandman in the first 5 minutes. We're saving that for your topics for next week.
Well, okay, that's Mark's number three then. Edward Norton, best supporting performance in Fight Club.
And totally outshone Brad Pitt, which we all agree, in every scene.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Do you know what? I kind of don't agree. Because I would say that Norton is the lead, and I would say Brad Pitt is the supporting actor, and I would say that Brad Pitt is better than Norton. I think the supporting actor outshines the lead, but the opposite way to you.
Whoa. Well, that's good.
So let's have a fight.
Yeah. The First of all, we don't talk about it.
Okay, fine. Number two for me then, and I'd be surprised if this isn't in someone's list. Mm-hmm. Christoph Waltz.
I'm amazed you actually got his name right, for one thing.
Django Unchained, I've gone with.
Yeah, good choice.
King Schultz outshines Django.
Yeah.
Completely. I actually did mention it when the topic came up. I said I could think of two in Django, mm-hmm. and it was Calvin Candy, Leonardo DiCaprio, and King Schultz, yeah. Christoph Waltz. But Waltz just absolutely nails it.
It doesn't take a lot to outshine Jamie Foxx in anything, but they go above and beyond, both of the two guys you mentioned there. But yeah, Christoph Waltz is unbelievable in that. And, you know, again, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but you could have had Christoph Waltz for Inglourious Basterds as well.
Yeah, definitely.
He's a scene stealer.
I did kind of put both down and think whichever one I felt like on the day, really. Mm-hmm. But it was Django for me. I just think in Django, as great as Hans Lander is as a villain, I just think in Django he is more of a supporting character in Django.
Yeah.
So it just seems to fit more for me.
Yep, I would agree.
Yeah, totally agree. Put him in any film. If you get the script and you're the lead actor, you just would quit, I think. You don't go against him.
He was the one. Before we started recording, I mentioned there was sort of a fourth that I knocked off my list. That was
just
my number
four. For that purpose,
it was so close. But I knew that one of you guys would have it, so I thought, no, I'll just squeeze him out.
Nice.
So my number two is a film that I don't know whether you guys will have seen or not. Have you guys seen a film called Glengarry Glen Ross?
No, I've not.
No,
actually.
I've heard the title, but yeah, I've never seen it.
It's a brilliant film about a gang of salesmen who work sort of in a telesales office. So they're travelling salesmen, but they're office-based as well. And it's about them always needing the new leads to get out there, and it's about how shitty their lives are. It came from a play, so it's very wordy. There's very little action in it. But the scene and it stars Al Pacino and it stars Kevin Spacey, but the scene stealer is Alec Baldwin, who is in literally one scene. And he's the guy who comes into the office and has the new leads. And you know, he says things like, he comes up with this motto, ABC, always be closing. Like, oh, can we have some coffee? No, coffee's for closers and all this sort of stuff. And he tears them to shreds in just one scene. He's in about 5 minutes of the film. And it's the best thing in it by a mile. It's a brilliant film, all ends up. But Alec Baldwin steals every inch of that film.
I need to watch that.
Yeah, check it out.
I think I definitely will, actually. I think that's a good shout. I think I might actually go and watch that if it's that good.
And one of my favourite lines is it was when he first comes into the office and one of the guys says to him, what's your name? Fuck you, that's my name. Brilliant line.
Please stop swearing about it, cheap and sick.
Sorry, mate.
My number two is Heath Ledger as the Joker in The Dark Knight. I'm not sure if you guys have picked him as number one.
Now, I'm going to guess that Adam's got him as number one.
Nope.
Oh. I have.
Okay. Do I need to say, have you ever seen The Dark Knight?
No.
Basically, it's a Batman film by Christopher Nolan, and he outshines everything of anyone ever as a villain in any superhero film. But in this film itself, my God, his entrance, everything about him is unbelievable.
I'll
we can sit here and talk for 20 minutes about him, but there's no
I
way that any other performance gets close to him in that film.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I like Christian Bale as Batman. I know some people have issues with him and, you know, the silly voice he puts on and whatnot, but I think he's really good in those films. But you can't possibly deny that Ledger steals that film from him.
No, you can't. Not at all. The reason he's not in my list is because I feel that as good as Bale is, he generally gets outshone in every single one of the Batman films. I mean, if you're going to choose Ledger, you could choose Liam Neeson as Ra's al Ghul. You could even choose Tom Hardy as Bane. Mm. You can choose Michael Caine as Alfred. I just think he puts in a better... Gary Oldman.
Or I think you've made the point to me before, not so long ago, about Cillian Murphy, even as Scarecrow.
I just think Nolan's universe of Batman, and I love it for this, one of the reasons why I love it so much, is so much more central on the Batman villains more than the Batman himself. And that's the reason why I kind of left him out of my list. Because in my eyes, and this isn't fact or truth, but in my eyes, Ledger is the lead actor in that film. And obviously, it's a Batman film, so you can't class it as that respect.
Nor did the Oscars.
Nor did the Oscars. But for me, I think that the Joker is the one that holds that film together.
It's interesting, really, isn't it? Because we're picking these films like Fight Club and stuff, where they are classed as the supporting actor, but because they steal the show so much, you do take it as they're the main actor, but they're not.
Because they're what you go away with when you leave the cinema, that's what's in your mind.
So fair play to these actors for making us, basically...
Brilliant, fantastic. And Ledger, I mean, I could talk about Ledger's performance just until the cows come home, really. I love it that much. I think he is quintessentially the Joker.
Here's a question for you.
In the modern world.
Here's a question for you, and this is, we're wildly speculating here, but do you think, had he not died, that he still would have won the Oscar?
No.
You don't think he would have? You think that was just sort of
I think the promise
a reward
is great,
for death?
But the Oscars generally don't reward comic book movies.
No.
And I don't think they would have rewarded him as such unless he had died.
No, it's true.
And it's sad to say because it is a performance worthy of a nomination at least.
Yeah.
But I don't think he'd have got it.
No, I would agree with you, to be honest, yeah. I think that him dying swung it towards him. I think he'd have been one of the front runners anyway, but yeah.
Not taking anything away from him because he deserves the Oscar for
it. Hell yeah.
Even looking at the category, you think he probably did put in the best performance. But the Academy rarely recognises a comic book film actor in that respect.
Yeah.
So J.K. Simmons, if you're listening right now, die in the next 2 weeks, you'll win.
Is Whiplash a comic?
Say again? Well, if he dies, he's going to go and get the best supporting actor at the Oscars next...
I think he's going to...
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
I wouldn't
anyone that's struggling,
trying that.
Yeah.
Just wait.
You'll never know.
Don't take the risk, to be honest, J.K.
Leave it, J.K.
Number one time. So,
well, I've done mine.
Ben's done his with Heath Ledger.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with one that I was quite surprised wasn't in Ben's. Have you done number two yet?
Yeah. I did. Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh,
Alan Alda.
So number one for me was Javier Bardem.
Me too.
No Country.
No Country.
Yeah, another one I considered.
Anton Chigurh completely steals the film.
Yeah,
just absolutely. And this, the weirdest thing about this topic is when I was trying to come up with ones that we hadn't really spoke about the films before, but I'd just be sitting here lying on the cast, and I didn't want to do that to the listeners. You know, it's horrible to do that. So I had to just go with the guys that were the best for me.
Yeah,
and Anton Chigurh's he's the man. Bardem steals that film completely as Anton Chigurh. And to be honest, it's not the only time. I mean, if you look at Skyfall...
Yes, he's excellent in that, yeah.
Bardem steals the show there for me as well. So Javier Bardem is just one of those actors that can just... Again, like Waltz, I guess. If he's the supporting actor and you're the lead actor, give up.
Yeah, just don't turn up. Shouldn't have to. The reason why I didn't pick that one... is, and I agree, he does steal the film, but I really like Josh Brolin in that film. I think he's very underrated in that film. So I think he does a very good job. That's why I felt like it would be a slight on him to pick Bardem. But no, I mean, I can't really disagree with you. It was very close to being in my
list. I really thought it was going to be in yours. I really thought, I was waiting for you to say it. And I'll be honest, Adam, I thought you were going to pick Heath Ledger's number one. So I agree with you on number one. I've put him down, No Country for Old Men. And his facial expressions alone in that film are better than anything else. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
And I mean, other supporting performances, I mean, Tommy Lee Jones as well.
Yeah.
In No Country. I mean, it's another great supporting actor's performance.
It is.
But, you know, it's no slight on Josh Brolin. He is fantastic in it. But these guys they just put in a great performance as well. And Chigurh, or Bardem as Chigurh, just takes it.
We put this out to our social network. So Twitter, which is at STTE Podcast. We've had loads of new people sign up and start following us. So thanks for that. And a lot have actually contributed this week. So we've had Carlo, who is at Doc Brown PhD. That's a great name on Twitter. He's chose Morgan Freeman in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So,
okay,
it's all right.
It's not hard to steal the film from Kevin Costner, is it? Because he's shit in that.
Terrible. We've had Nocturnus Film, which is at Nocturnus Film. Tommy Lee Jones in Under Siege.
Yeah.
I forgot he was even in that. Is that a Steven Seagal film?
I don't even know. Sorry. We've had The Blaze, which is at 90210. Ethan Hawke in Boyhood.
Still haven't seen it yet, so I can't judge.
And Ian McKellen in Lord of the Rings.
I'm saying nothing.
Okay.
Ben's favourite trilogy, that is.
Shite.
He just believes that, you know, if you're going to choose a supporting actor, it needs to be the guy who played Samwise Gamgee.
We had William, which is at... William to Life with Angelina Jolie in Girl Interrupted.
Never seen it.
They're picking all the films today that none of us have seen, which is always good. We've had Brett Lauchet, which is at Grey Weirdo, with Joe Pesci in Almost Anything, but mostly Goodfellas.
Definitely.
I think Joe Pesci is a fantastic choice just for the fact that, again, he's like Waltz.
Yeah.
And Bardem.
Turn up, steal the show, walk away.
He'll steal the show.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon 4. Brilliant in that.
They've also said Harrison Ford as Han Solo, arguably.
Yeah, he's sort of a co-lead, though, isn't he?
That's an odd one, because I think Lucas kind of wrote the film with Solo as his main lead, I guess. It was just, again, it's kind of the perception of people coming out of the cinema in which you believe Luke Skywalker is the lead.
Yeah.
Peter Zeke, which is at Peter Banner 1. Rick Moranis in Ghostbusters.
Yeah,
nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was a great one. That one.
Eddie Murphy in Trading Places.
Again, co-lead.
Yeah. And finally on Twitter, Pop Culture Case Study, which is at PC Case Study. Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs. See, again, I'd think lead actor, but it's not, is it? It's all about Jodie Foster.
He is supporting, I mean.
Yeah.
He's only in the film for about 5 minutes in total, isn't he?
Yeah.
And thanks to everyone on Facebook, which is facebook.com/skip-to-the-end. We've got Jessica Path Campbell with Philip Seymour Hoffman in Almost Famous. Don't agree, but that's a good shout. Ian
what?
Evans.
Doesn't make any sense.
It's a good shout. It's a nice nose that she's picked the film, but I don't agree. Ian Evans with Robert Patrick in Terminator 2.
Yeah,
good one.
Mark Holloway with Alan Rickman in both Robin Hood and Die Hard.
Yeah, I toyed with Rickman as well.
The way he did.
Ben Sinclair McDonald with The Basket in Basket Case. Ridiculous. Cy Lewis with Hugo Weaving in The Matrix.
Yeah.
And Gary Oldman and Christopher Walken in everything they've done, mostly True Romance.
Oldman's brilliant in True Romance, yeah.
Mark Holloway said Natalie Portman in Leon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say Gary Oldman in Leon.
Yeah, Gary Oldman in Leon.
Tim Berry, new to the podcast, so thank you. Jonah Hill in Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, he is a scene stealer, but that's because he seems to be acting in a different film to everyone else. Yeah. He's off doing a comedy, whereas the rest of them are doing sort of a semi-serious film.
Biopic.
Yeah.
Ben Slaughter with Martin Sheen in The Departed.
I would go with Mark Wahlberg in The Departed if I was picking one of the supporting.
If you're going to pick one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and finally Richard Booth with Stephen Lang in Avatar.
Never seen it, never will.
So, thanks to everyone that contributed. Right, Adam, it's your choice of topic for next episode, episode 14, so...
Yeah, that's fair enough. So, I mean, during the Oscars season so far, we've kind of spoken a bit about how Carell maybe didn't deserve his nomination.
Okay.
So, if we also look at the review that was recently done on skip2theend.co.uk... for American Sniper by Ben.
Mm-hmm.
Cooper's been nominated, and having seen the film myself now, arguably shouldn't have been.
Yeah, especially not at the expense of Jake Gyllenhaal.
So can you think of a top three actors, acting performances, that deserve nominations that didn't get them?
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Bonuses, if you can think of people that did get nominated that year that shouldn't have.
Oh, I see. So the three that we pick, the year that they weren't nominated...
Yeah.
Name someone who was nominated that year that they should have replaced, yeah. Effectively. Brilliant, I love it. Let's do that.
Perfect. So next week, we're going to be... you sum it up. People that deserved it, and then who didn't deserve it for any year of the Oscars.
This week we've been to see the new drama film Whiplash, written and directed by Damien Chazelle. It tells the story of Andrew, played by Miles Teller, as he attends a prestigious music conservatory. And it tells about the sadistic band leader that he has to deal with, Fletcher, played by J.K. Simmons. So, before we get deep into a review, Mark, sum it up in one word.
Astonishing.
Adam?
Unbelievable.
For me, it's thrilling.
Nice. So, on your poster, that was the first time you could do it.
Yeah.
Astonishing. Incredible.
Thrilling.
Yeah.
So I think it's safe to say we all enjoyed it.
No.
No?
Unbelievably terrible.
Ah, I see. Come on, let's put some flesh on these bones then, Mark.
Whiplash was just unbelievable. I've not been to see a film at the cinema where I've been on the edge of my seat for probably a good hour.
Yeah.
My heart racing, tense, literally feeling like... just shaking at times, like so anxious and so... just really felt uncomfortable in some scenes. Like, I know everyone's been talking about J.K. Simmons and this amazing performance, but I kind of went in there like, keep grounded, Mark. This, you've built it up too much, but he still delivered a better performance than I was even expecting. And I don't think I can remember a time I've come out of the cinema so kind of... like I drank six cans of Red Bull. I was literally wired. Like, it was a real epic
it's nerve-shredding. And the funny thing about it is, you know, you can watch other films that are nerve-shredding because, you know, they're horrors or because they have high-impact action scenes or chase scenes or whatever it might be. This is nerve-shredding, not only because J.K. Simmons is a force of nature in the film, but also just things like the end of the film, a bit of a spoiler alert, there's a scene where Andrew Miles Teller's character is playing a drum solo at Carnegie Hall, and it's a 9-minute long drum solo, and I was on the edge of my seat for a drum solo. Just how brilliantly he was doing, and the editing was fantastic, and the direction and all those things had me on edge,
and Fletcher coming over to try and put him off as he's playing it,
putting him off at first, but then getting into it as
but
it
then
went
he starts to realise this kid is the real deal.
Yeah,
I mean, I'll just kind of, I guess, sum up the whole reason that J.K. Simmons Fletcher kind of establishes this sadistic mentality is because Jazzrummer Charlie Parker once was sort of in a session one time. He was playing, he wasn't playing very well, and I think it was Joe Jones threw a cymbal at his head to try and spur him on to be one of the best of all time. And obviously Charlie Parker, you know, laughed off stage and kind of really then wanted to be the best of all time, and it spurred him on. So Fletcher is trying to get one of his students to be one of the greatest of all time.
Yeah.
And he does this by putting them through hell, basically. Because his whole point, I think at one point, there's a bit of a scene where they're sitting down, and Andrew even says to him, "Do you not worry that you discourage the next Charlie Parker?" And he goes, "You go over the line and discourage him." And J.K. Simmons Fletcher says, "The next Charlie Parker would never be discouraged."
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of it. As he's doing this 9-minute drum solo, you can see it in Fletcher's eyes. He's getting into it. He's realising that he's in a sadistic way, he's done this.
Mm.
He's created this fantastic drummer.
Yeah, because prior to that, and again, you know, heavy spoiler alert here, he'd basically tricked... They've been at the conservatory together at this, I think it's called the Schaefer School.
Yeah.
J.K. Simmons had treated Fletcher, had treated Andrew really badly. Andrew had then managed to get Fletcher kicked out of the school. Fletcher then ends up running this jazz ensemble that are playing a show at the Carnegie Hall. Fletcher then sort of tricks Andrew into thinking that they're all fine and he doesn't blame him for anything, blah, 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 and he's going to come and do the performance with him at Carnegie Hall.
He says, we're playing Whiplash
and Caravan, the standards, but then he throws in a song by an unknown artist that Andrew couldn't possibly have known, and he's not given the music to work from. So Andrew gets up and walks off after this, after being embarrassed at Carnegie Hall. But then, as he's walking away, hugs his dad, he then turns back and you know, you see the look of determination in his eye, goes back, sits in his seat, doesn't even wait for Fletcher to count him in, just launches in.
Into Whiplash or Caravan or one of the old classics. And there's actually a scene slightly before it, kind of, they go on stage where J.K. Simmons Fletcher is giving a speech, and he's saying that, you know, the greatest minds are out there, the people for like the Lincoln Conservatory and people like that are out there. And he goes, and these guys have got good memories, you know. If you're brilliant, they'll sign you up and you'll be playing these big shows for the rest of your life. Whereas if you do poorly, you might as well look for a new career.
Yeah.
And that's his whole thing is that. So he gets Andrew out there, and just as they're about to start, he walks over to him and says, "Do you think I'm a fucking idiot?
Yeah.
I know it was you.
And then buries him.
But then Andrew comes out and just does the complete opposite. He plays this incredible version of it. I think it's Caravan.
He does it. Yeah.
That he plays, and he just, this 9-minute drum solo, I mean, it's so intense to watch.
Yeah.
But it's just fantastic.
I think if you would have said to me beforehand, you're going to sit through a 9-minute drum solo, I'd have groaned. And then you said, no, you're going to sit through it and be thrilled and, you know, just full of nerves on the edge of your seat because of it, I'd have called you a liar.
Yeah.
But it's amazing.
Crazy. Like, 9 minutes is a long time.
It is.
And to sit there and think, that whole shot is him, you know, playing the beat, and then it's just this one scene where it's just him slowing it right down. And I know that Fletcher walks over and is like telling him, take it down. And there's probably just 20 seconds of just the drum, the snare being hit by the drumstick, and it's really slow and builds up. And my heart was literally about to explode. Like, all I'm seeing is this drum, but the way it's filmed, the focus, the way it was filmed was perfect. And you're just seeing, like, even the bits of kind of sweat dripping onto the snare and the blood on his hands, and you're like, this is unbelievable. And it kind of builds up then and builds up, and the tension builds up, and you're watching Fletcher kind of just, I know it sounds ridiculous, but jizzing, isn't he? He's so excited. He really is, though, isn't he?
I don't know.
He's so excited. He's like, I've done it. I've created this monster, but the monster's unbelievable and done everything that he wanted. He's building up, his hands are shaking. And then he goes off and just, oh, the drumming is... I'm not a drummer, I don't know if it was accurate, but it looked like he was playing beat for beat. Well, that was done,
apparently Miles Teller's in his mid-20s now, I think, but he's been playing drums since he was about 14 or 15 anyway. But then he took extensive lessons. I think it was something like 4 hours a day, 3 days a week.
Just to get to that level.
To get to that level. And it was, apparently there were some scenes where they had a body double, but all the drumming you heard was genuinely Miles Teller. And it's phenomenal. Even, you know, keeping the time, keeping the beat is one thing, but the pure speed of it, you know, the way that Teller is grimacing in pain and anguish, trying to play at this pace.
His fingers are bleeding.
And, you know, again, some of that was prosthetics and makeup. Some of it was his very real blood because he pushed himself to the limit.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, this was kind of an opposite effect of Foxcatcher in a way. I mean, if you've not heard our Foxcatcher review, you can hear it on episode 12. Yeah. It's on the website, skip to the end.co.uk. But when I saw the trailer for Foxcatcher, I was very much excited for the film.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this is going to be brilliant. It looks like a thriller. It looks like an amazing drama biopic. And then I came out of the review last week and I said that the trailer did missold the film completely.
Yeah.
I saw the trailer for this film and I thought, a film about drumming? Weird. Wasn't really interested at all. Started reading a few bits and pieces here and there about J.K. Simmons mainly, and obviously everyone was raving about him. So it kind of piqued my interest a bit. So I went in to watch the film thinking, this could be quite good. Mm-hmm. I did not expect it to be this good.
No.
And it's just that opposite effect of how less is more in a trailer sometimes. So they've sold this film superbly. And you kind of think, it can't just be a film about drumming. And it's not. Drumming is the, I guess, the plot device.
Yeah, it's the framing device of the whole thing, the drumming, yeah.
But the major plot is between these two people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their relationship and how it starts off on, well, probably a bad foot, I guess. I mean, the opening scene is brilliant. It's just Andrew, Miles Teller, playing the drums, and then Fletcher comes in, because he hears him playing, and he kind of chastises him a bit. I think he says at one point, why did you stop playing? You know who I am? Yeah. So you know I'm looking for players? Yes. So why did you stop playing?
Yeah.
So he starts playing again. He goes, so that's your response? I ask you a question and you start playing.
Did I tell you to start playing? Yeah.
And then he asks him to give him like double time swing, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Starts playing that and then he looks up and he's just walked out. He comes back in because he forgot his coat.
It's a really good intro to the film. It captures you straight away. You're not like, oh, it's going to be a build-up, we're going to get to know the characters. You know instantly that this guy is the master and this little kid is just literally in awe. Mm. And to have your hero walk in and basically say, ah, you're shit.
It's a perfect way of introducing both characters as well, because it really does show you what frame of mind they're in. Because Fletcher's Fletcher. He's you know, he doesn't change really throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Andrew does. So we see Andrew as the naive Schaefer school student who's just playing the drums, you know, trying to get better, but not to the level he's trying to get better after he meets Fletcher. And Fletcher's the guy who doesn't even give him a second look at the start.
Yeah. Or it would appear that way. Because we later find out, you know, Fletcher's saying that's all part of his technique.
Yeah.
He encourages them by being withholding. He wants to create in them a self-belief that they need to work harder to get better. I forget the exact quote, but he says something like, the worst words you can say are,
good job,
that's it. Because then, where do you go from there? Oh, fine, then I won't work as hard.
There are no two words in the English language more damaging than good job.
Yeah. And that's his whole, that sums up his whole ethos.
Yeah.
That's why he throws chairs across the room. That's why he rips them to shreds verbally. That's why he makes him cry. That's why he slaps him across the face.
One of the most intense moments for me was just where he gets the band together at 9 o'clock at night.
Mm.
And he's sitting there, he gets, you know, Andrew's, he gets Connolly first on drums, who came from Andrew's class as well. And he starts screaming at him, even after he's been nice to him to start with.
Yeah.
Starts screaming at him. Then he gets Andrew back on. Starts screaming at him, and he starts telling the whole band, you know, take a break because we're going to be here until one of these guys can play in my time.
Yeah.
And I think the clock's just going by, you know, 10, half 11,
yeah.
1, and eventually it's about half 2 before he even calls the band back in because Andrew's finally got it.
Yeah. He says, you've earned your position or earned something, yeah. It's frightening, really, the intensity of it, obviously, of Fletcher's character.
And the realism.
Yeah, I mean, and by all accounts, there is an element of realism in it. Like, Damien Chazelle was a music prodigy. He went to one of these kind of schools. Yeah. So he's experienced these kind of characters, and then he based him a little bit on, you know, famous drummers that have been around in the past.
Yeah.
So this isn't just some complete movie monster. There is a lot of realism there.
Yeah.
People do have this kind of drive and this kind of intensity.
These are the types of, you know, conductors and composers, I guess, that you do get teaching at these schools or lecturing at these schools. they're the ones that demand so much from everyone they work with, because not only do they want everyone in their band to be the best, mm-hmm. they want to be known as the best for, in what they do.
Yeah.
And as for a conductor, being the best at doing what you do is getting that band together. So it is. It is about this movie monster. But as I say, when I talk about realism, there's a fantastic scene in which he's chastising him because a bus is broken down. Andrew's had to get a rental car to get to the event. He's got to the event, but he's left his drumsticks back at the rental car place. Yeah. So he tells him, he's basically, if you're not on stage at 5:30, then you know, Connolly's got your spot.
Yeah.
And I think Andrew just screams at him for the first time he ever really stands up for himself. And then he drives off and he ends up getting in a car accident, but he runs to the event and he's sitting there and he's got blood all over his face, blood all over his hands, blood all over his arms, and he actually sits down. And this is what Fletcher's done to him. He's in a car accident, he still sits down to try and play drums.
Yeah.
And he's actually passing out as he's playing them. And this is what I mean about the realism, because in a Hollywood film, how many times have we seen a situation in which, you know, they're injured, they're damaged, and they still go ahead and play the show, and they play it brilliantly and superbly, and it's the best performance of their life. But no, he starts passing out, he's playing terrible.
Dropping the sticks every minute, yeah.
And then just says, you're done, to him at the end, and kicks him out of the school.
Talking about that scene, actually, where he's in the car, that's probably one of my favourite scenes, and the way they actually film and edit that actual car accident is unbelievable. You actually see from the, it's the passenger's window, it's like the red lorry coming towards. The way that was edited and filmed, brilliant.
The sound afterwards.
Absolutely brilliant. You just didn't see
it coming because you were focusing on him. You know, he's driving way over the limit, but you're focusing on him. He's, you know, you're just wanting to get there and arrive.
Yeah.
The last thing on your mind is thinking a truck's going to come and cream him, and it does.
It does.
And the car flips. It's upside down, and he crawls out, gets his stick
covered
out.
Covered in blood.
And runs.
Are you okay, mate? Are you okay? Yeah. What are you doing? No, I need to go. Just runs off down the street.
And then obviously Fletcher tells him he's done, and then he attacks him on stage and he's kicked out of the school. And
he sort of rugby tackles Fletcher, which apparently in real life, sort of, I think, either bruised or broke two of J.K. Simmons' ribs.
Wow. that's the realism,
I guess. That is the realism, yeah.
Commitment.
Commitment. So we've sort of danced around it a little bit, but let's talk about the acting. I think we've got to start with Simmons. It is as good as people say it is.
Yeah.
It is worthy of every award that it's won and every award that it's been nominated for. It should win the Oscar. I loved Edward Norton in Birdman. He was one of the better things about a film I didn't particularly enjoy. But Simmons has pissed all over him from a great height, quite honestly. This is a performance for the ages. One of the best bad guy performances you will ever see.
Oh, by far. Yeah. By far.
It's the way he acts, it's the way he speaks. Some of the phrases that he comes out with, which are sort of racist or homophobic or fattist. He's horrible, but he's hilarious.
I mean, and it's all, again, his entire character, the entire performance, is summed up in about probably the first 20 minutes when he notices that one of the band's out of tune.
Mm.
And he gets them all to start playing in the different sections. He finds the section and then he's going along one by one and he says to the chubby kid, I guess, doesn't he?
Bubbly.
He says, are you out of tune? And he just says, I'm sorry, sir. He's like, get out, what are you still doing here? Get out of my studio. Tells him to get out, and then he just turns around after he's left and says, for the record, you're out of tune. He wasn't, but he didn't know, and that's bad enough.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Absolutely brutal.
And he's got a little smirk on his face when he says it as well.
Literally, he delights in causing these people pain and hell because he's hoping it's a baptism of fire for them.
But I think one of the things that's quite good about this is we can choose to take him at face value. We can choose to believe the explanation he gives that he's only acting like this to push them to limits they never knew they could reach. But because we're having to take his word for it, there's also the fact that he might just be a sadistic
bastard.
Yeah,
he might just enjoy it.
That could be bullshit. That's the easy story that he tells himself or tells others, but the truth of it is he's just a nasty piece of work.
But he likes being mean and evil to people.
Yeah. So, but it's a brilliant performance, and I think he's matched, actually, beat for beat. Pun not intended, sorry, by Miles Teller.
Yeah, I was actually going to talk about Teller because Teller, for me, how he's not been nominated in the Best Actor category.
Yeah.
And Steve Carell has.
Yeah.
And Bradley Cooper has.
I can't believe it. I mean, there isn't a scene in this film without Miles Teller in it.
No.
He is literally in every scene. Yeah. I read that, yeah.
He is the focal point of the film. Mm. The whole film follows him around, and he is in every scene. There is not a scene without him.
Yeah. And not only is his acting performance good, the acting side of it is great. Something that happens a lot is that actors will be rewarded for for physicality.
Yeah.
You know, you gain 50 pounds or you become emaciated and you get rewarded for that, you know. The physicality of just the drumming, just him playing drums, that in and of itself, the intensity of the fire of that deserves an award, plus the fact that the acting bits are brilliant as well.
I genuinely feel sorry for him because I think Simmons is that good. It's taken focus off him.
Would you say that he is a supporting film that is...
I would most definitely say that, yeah. But I just think that Simmons is so good that the Academy have kind of ignored Teller.
Yeah.
It's a damn shame. That is a damn shame.
It is. When the film first came out at a couple of festivals, sort of this time last year, people were talking about Miles Teller as a potential Oscar nominee, but that just faded over time because people jumped on the Simmons bandwagon and, you know, other Oscar nominees were bandied around. And it is a real shame.
Both of them should be in there.
They should, yeah.
Miles Teller, for me, was... Basically, he demonstrated every emotion you could ever try and put into a film. He goes from being the little weedy kid at the start, you see him change to the actual confident that goes up against Fletcher, that kind of even beats Fletcher when he gets him suspended or sacked from the school, doesn't he?
Yeah.
You kind of he's victorious, but he isn't because he's not benefited or done what he wants to do. You see the other side to him, and in the end, you're rooting for him, and you think there's not many films where a character can flip it so much, but you believe it. It's not like you. Yeah. I was sat there going, you know what? I'm convinced by everything you do in this film.
This is the interesting thing for me because, as far as the character goes, Andrew actually gets worse over time as well. The more time he spends with Fletcher, the worse person he becomes.
And there's a great bit of that in the middle of the film when he's seeing a girl, Nicole, played I don't know how to pronounce her surname. I'm going to say it's Benoist. It's probably Benoist something, yeah. And he's been going out with her, dating her for a few months, and he takes her to a restaurant to basically break up with her, and it's the most cold-hearted breakup you'll ever see. He says to her straight out, we're going to break up now, because all that's going to happen is, I'm not going to be able to spend time with you, you're going to resent me for not spending time with you because I'm doing too much practice, I'll then resent you for resenting me, it's going to end badly, so we're going to end now.
Yeah.
And he's like, and she's like, so you're so sure this is the way it's going to go? Yes. And he breaks up with her, and it's so cold.
Done.
And that's the way where did you compare that to half an hour earlier in the film when he first asks her out on a date and he's the shy boy speaking to the girl who works in the cinema, you know, falling for her silly jokes.
He was so besotted, wasn't he? Yeah. You saw him with his little, like, bloody...
He just gets... The more time he spends with Fletcher, the worse he becomes as a person as well.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how after everything, because of how bad Fletcher is, you're still on his side at the end of it. But I think when you take a step back, you realise, actually, they're as bad as each other.
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing about this film. I'm always rooting for Fletcher as well. I always kind of... When he came back and got the job and, you know, he did the biggest kind of heel turn. It was horrible. You know, the fact that he actually... You know, I know it was you. You know, screw you. That was... I was still like, fair play. That's pretty good to go that far and that amount of distance just to screw this Andrew guy back over and go, you know, 1-0 up, you know.
I mean, there aren't a great deal of characters in this film, to be honest, really, that kind of show through, but that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, I never hated him, and as bad as he is, and awful and evil in some way, I was so chuffed that I always wanted to
boot
him. I
think the fact that there is such a lack of other characters in the film, it means you do start looking for reasons to root for the ones that are. That makes sense?
Possibly. The thing I liked about the film is that at the end of it was a tie.
Yeah.
You know, Fletcher was a dick to begin with, Andrew screwed him over, Fletcher screwed him back, but then in the process of that 9-minute solo, they came to some sort of detente where, you know...
Oh, they respected each other.
They respected the hell out of each other because they pulled something off, something special, and they were in it together by the end of it.
Like, Fletcher realised he'd been beaten, but Andrew realised he wouldn't have beat Fletcher without Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was no way he'd have become that good a drummer without Fletcher.
Without pushing him to those
extremes. Yeah, it's a ridiculous, ridiculous thing, but they're just this... mutual respect between the two. And the interesting thing about it is, as bad as Fletcher and Andrew's relationship gets, Andrew's relationship with his father, Jim, played by Paul Reiser, gets worse as well.
Mm.
There's a scene when they're at like a family dinner and he's talking, I think his uncle's talking about his cousin, basically, or his son and Andrew's cousin, saying that he's just made a record in like college football or is it high school football? And Andrew just says, yeah, in the third division.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says, come play with us. And he says four words you'll never hear from the NFL.
Mm.
And then his dad just turns around and says, or the Lincoln Center?
Harsh.
And Andrew just gets up and walks off. But you just see the breakdown in their relationship the more he starts to drum as well.
Mm.
And it's quite heartbreaking, really.
Shame.
So let's have a talk about the direction then. Again, we've sort of touched on it. For a guy, I think it's only his second film that he's directed. I think he was 29 at the time of making it. Did it in something like 18 days. It's a superbly directed film.
It's unbelievable, yeah.
Like some of the shots of, again, you wouldn't think that watching someone drum and close-up shots of snare drums would be interesting, but it is. And you wouldn't think that shots of a conductor waving his arms could be as brilliantly compelling as they are. It's superb direction and editing.
It's the looks that the characters give each other. And it's, I mean, we spoke about the car scene as well, where it's from the passenger side and we see the lorry or the truck kind of oncoming. And there's just so many brilliant moments like that. And just the general kind of put together of the film. I mean, there's a bit where it's just kind of silent as Andrew's drumming, and then he gets so angry with himself for not being able to do something, he just punches his way through his own drum kit.
Yeah.
And it's just the way that they shoot that was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really good. That's one of the things that stood out for me. Even the scene where there's his hands in ice and you're seeing it slowly go through. The scenes where the rest of the music groups, it's not all just about the drummer, everyone else in the group is always on edge. You know, as soon as Fletcher walks in the room, all of them, and he captures kind of that emotion of all these whole group's faces. And I remember there's one scene where he goes into the room, and as he enters, they all stand up. It's as if, like, Hitler's coming, and they're all and they all stand up, and there's the sound, all you hear is just like a pin drop. He's here. He walks in the room, and just before they play, you'll see one of the horns just, you know, the spits drop on the floor that's come out, and it hits the floor, and it's just the way he captures it, honestly, you're just stood there waiting for something bad to happen.
It's the fact that, like you say, with the shots with the band, where they're all kind of tuning up, and the moment it gets kind of 9 seconds, they all stop, and then you can hear his footsteps coming, and literally as the clock, it shows the clock, as it hits 9, he opens the door and walks in.
Bang on time.
Brilliant director, and I'm really excited to kind of know that it's only his second film, and I'm looking forward to kind of what he's got next, you know, being really exciting, because, let's be honest, he can go anywhere with this now. Give him a big budget, let's see what he can do.
It's a shame, I think, that he wasn't nominated for the Oscar for Best Director. I think because it's been such a strong year that it was always going to be an uphill battle for a new guy. But I'm glad to see that the editing has been nominated for an Oscar, because the editing of the drum playing, as we've said earlier, is phenomenal, really, the quick cuts and such. So that I'm really glad that's been. And I'm glad it's been nominated for Best Picture as well, because it is.
It just feels like it should have more. It should have more nominations.
Oh, yeah, it should be nominated for everything. I mean, it should be nominated for Best Animated Film, as far as I'm concerned. It's everything it should get.
Well, you've got an adapted screenplay, I think, it's the other one, isn't it? It's in for as well. So, be interesting to see how it does in that field.
Mm-hmm.
If, and it's a massive if, J.K. Simmons doesn't win, I lose all my faith in the Academy and I will never watch it ever again.
I was actually looking at the kind of the
I'm serious.
It'd be like Roman Reigns winning the...
I will just be disgusted. I there's no way.
Actually, yeah, looking at the odds on this, I think he was 1 to 25.
Yeah.
The last time I checked.
I think he and Julianne Moore for Still Alice, they are the two frontrunners that are just unassailable favourites now, supposedly.
If you want to see our predictions for the nominations, and we did the roundup of the winners, which I won, which was pretty good.
You did.
That's on skiptheend.co.uk. Check that out.
Yeah. And and then on our next episode, actually, you might as well say it while we're here, we will be doing our final Oscar predictions in the run-up to the big show.
It's going to be so hard.
Yeah.
So then, we're doing scores on the doors?
Yes, absolutely. I'll go first. I can't, in good conscience, give any film a 10, really. I don't know what a film would have to be to get 10 out of 10 for me. But this is as close as it could possibly be. This is a 9.999. You know, it's 9 out of 10 for me. This is an amazing film. And I'm so happy it is so good, because I've been so let down by the other big
I agree.
American Sniper is an absolute... a piece of shit, and you can read my review for that on the website as well. Foxcatcher massively disappointed me. Birdman wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be, so I was so happy that one of these films finally lived up to my expectations and lived up to the hype. It's brilliant.
And just echoing the sentiment there of American Sniper, we didn't actually all go and see that together. Ben wrote his review and I read it, and I said that I wanted to review it at the time before his review went out, and he said, well, only if your view is different to mine. So I went to see it just to see if it was, and I came out thinking it was just the worst thing I'd seen this year.
Garbage.
on that note, I'm not going to bother seeing it. I'll save my money because both of you have not sold it to me at all. And I will be going to see Big Hero 6, which I'll review and put on the website skiptheend.co.uk.
Excellent. So Ben's giving it a 9, Mark. Whiplash, you gave Birdman a 9, I think. That was your highest rated Oscar film.
I agree with Ben. Do you know what? I can't give it a 10 because I don't know what would ever be a 10. I'm going to give it a 9. And it is the highest 9. And now that makes Birdman for me probably a 7. It's that much of a good 9. You know, it really is. It's a perfect film.
I think that's fair enough. I mean, I've spoken before. I think I gave Guardians of the Galaxy a 9.
Mm-hmm.
Way back when, on our first ever episode, believe it or not. At that point, I think I said, to get a 10, you kind of have to have staying power. So I'd have to think that film was that great after 10 years for even think about upgrading it to a 10. So this is a 9 for me as well. I just think it's that good.
So what you're saying is, when we come back and do the Whiplash as a 10
year,
rewatch,
10-year anniversary
years,
edition,
then it might climb
it
up
might
to a 10.
Get itself to a 10 then. But it's a 9 for me as well. I mean, there is so much good to say about this film,
mm-hmm.
and so little bad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have said anything negative about it. And I think if we tried to, I'd be splitting hairs.
Yeah, yeah.
So the bad thing is we can't go and watch it every day because everything else gets in the way. I just want to go and watch it again and again and again. When this comes out on Blu-ray, I hope they do features on the editing and the filming and special features because I want to know everything about this film. And, you know, Miles Teller, you've got a good future ahead of you. You're in Fantastic Four.
Yeah, Reed Richards. Yeah.
And,
Fantastic
you know,
Four.
Let's see what you can do. Cause
So just out of curiosity now, just for the kind of listeners of Skip to the End who've listened to the old cast as well, Mark, is J.K. Simmons now a more finer actor than the Sandman for you?
Never in a million years.
That's it, stick to your guns, Landon.
Thank you.
So you got a 9.
Skip to the End rating for Whiplash, 9 out of 10. Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the first annual Skip to the End Awards, or the Skippies. It's where we look back at the year 2014 in movies and tell you everything that was terrible, awful, rubbish and garbage.
And dog shit.
Oh, and dog shit. Let's not forget that, yeah. So we've got 6 different awards to give away, and Adam, you're going to start us off with the first category.
I am, and I'm terribly excited, Ben.
Excellent.
I am. I just think this is something that I can see all the faces out in the audience today. They're all really hoping that they take the Skippy home today.
Yeah, and I'm so glad they dressed up for the occasion as well.
So
they're all in their tuxedos.
I wish Mark had. He's just in his pants.
Yep.
That's better.
So the first Skippy we have to give out today is Worst Screenplay. Now, this is a very contentious category this year.
Mm-hmm.
I can see a lot of good nominees. So the nominees for this one are Aaron Kruger with Transformers Age of Extinction. We also have Chris Nolan and John Nolan with Interstellar. And the final nominee is Adi Hasak and Luc Besson for 3 Days to Kill. And the Skippy goes to 3 Days to Kill, Adi Hasak and Luc Besson.
You know, there is a big saying in France, when you have nothing to say, just shut your mouth. And after 10 films and 30 years of loyal services, I have nothing to say.
So, the award has gone to 3 Days to Kill.
Yes, and I'm quite happy. I think that's fully deserved. I mean, we look at Interstellar as a film, we think, you know, this is a very tough category this year. Because Interstellar, Transformers Age of Extinction, 3 Days to Kill, they could have all taken it.
Yeah.
But 3 Days to Kill for me is a worthy winner. I mean, it's essentially just a Taken rip-off, and Taken isn't even that good.
Yeah, why would you rip off a shit series of films?
Exactly.
Especially if you're Luc Besson, who's done a lot of garbage in recent years, but, you know, he's a guy that's done great things back in the day.
It's like Kevin Costner. This is Taken 4, isn't it? Because basically now Liam Neeson's going to realise someone's taken his job.
Yeah. They're just looking now, Hollywood's looking for blokes who are in like their 60s and 70s and throwing them into action films.
I mean, this is one that the you know, the press had been all over, like, who's the Skippy? It's their first one. This is... some of the hype online about this has been insane, and I've read a lot about, oh, everyone, Transformers has got this nailed, you know. But Christopher Nolan, he did such a big piece of turd. Surely he deserves some credit, but, you know, this is a good win.
Yeah, not to take anything away from Maddie Hassack and Luke Besson, because it is a fully deserved Skippy, but I think the favourite with the bookmakers was actually Interstellar this year.
That's who I put my money on.
Yeah. So, oh, well, I mean, that's the first Skippy given out, so on to Skippy number two. So this is the worst actor, Skippy. So again, very contentious category this year.
There were a lot of potential nominees.
There were, and to even get it down to three was very difficult, I think. So the nominees for this one are Jeff Daniels for Dumb and Dumber 2, Jack Black in Sex Tape, and Adam Sandler in Blended. And the Skippy goes to Adam Sandler for Blended.
Hello, my name is Adam Sandler. Thank you so much for this wonderful award.
A well-deserved award there for Adam Sandler.
Yeah, I think it's actually, it's his first Skippy.
Yep.
But not the first time he's won the award for worst actor, I feel.
No, nor the last.
He's kind of the pedigree horse in these races.
He is the thoroughbred here that everyone else is racing against.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Very well known for being a terrible, terrible, terrible actor.
Now, as far as I'm aware, I believe that neither myself nor Mark have seen this film.
No.
And I believe, Adam, you saw how many minutes was it?
About 15 to 20.
And it was enough to realise that he was the worst actor of 2014.
By far.
I can't doubt that.
No, and again, it's Jeff Daniels. It's a great performance.
A lot of people have actually said that he was favourite, but they were worried that he might die before the actual awards are given out. So it was quite a relief to see that he didn't win, because you never know, he might not have been there to accept the award.
And myself and Mark are lucky enough not to have seen Sex Tape.
I've actually seen it.
You have seen it?
Yeah, because after Ben's glowing review...
Oh, excellent. Okay.
I went and checked it out, and it was the worst piece of shit I've seen in a very long time.
Jack Black was another nominee in this field for his role in Sex Tape.
Yeah.
So what were you saying about that? Was that deserved? Or?
Oh, it was fully deserved. It was an abysmal performance and an abysmal film. He plays a porn baron in a sort of an overextended cameo. It's a shame that his career has come to this. And I hate him for it.
So, I mean, did he top Gulliver's Travels? You know, that's the sort of thing.
The thing is, at least he was the lead in Gulliver's Travels. You know, at least he took home a fat paycheck for that and did 2 hours worth of work. This was 5 minutes worth of work.
He also took home a fat gut. Every night.
Brilliant.
Okay, so I mean, the Skippy goes to Adam Sandler then.
Moving on to our next category, this is the worst actress category, and our nominees are Cameron Diaz, Sex Tape, Anne Hathaway, Interstellar, Drew Barrymore, Blended. And the Skippy goes to Anne Hathaway for Interstellar.
Oh my gosh, this is happening. And thank you for putting me, my work, in this category with great and gutsy actresses. I have to thank you so much for being a vanguard against typecasting.
Yeah, I hate Anne Hathaway in this film so very much. I don't like Anne Hathaway much in general anyway, because as I've said before on the podcast, she's just basically a theatre school child who's been pushed onto the stage by her mother, and she still looks like it. I forgave her a little bit for Dark Knight Rises. I thought she was very good in that. But this was just her being the wide-eyed theatre school child again. She wasn't helped by the piss poor script.
Yeah.
All that shit about love being as powerful as science. Definitely not. No, just simply not true. And she couldn't sell it, but no one really could have. So it's not entirely her fault. But to me, this is an absolutely fully deserved award.
And interesting enough that you bring up, obviously, it's a scripting problem, because obviously Jonathan and Chris Nolan will be devastated that they didn't win the worst screenplay Skippy this year. So to have, I guess, their work recognised in the form of Anne Hathaway receiving the worst actress, I think it'd be a small comfort to them.
I assume so, yes.
Anne Hathaway, for me, I'm not sure if there's a condition out there, but if there is, she's got it. It's when you go from being a female to a male without paying for the actual sex change or anything. Because I remember Anne Hathaway coming onto the film scene in stuff like Devil Wears Prada, long hair, quite beautiful. Every time I've seen her recently, her hair's getting shorter, her ears are poking out, she's looking more and more like a man. And it's not just for the film she's in. If
That's
you look
not
at
true.
Her now...
It's because she shaved her head for Les Miserables, and every film since she's had short hair. It's not getting shorter, it's getting longer.
I don't know, she just seems to me to just be turning into a man. She's not as attractive, she's just starting to look really weird.
Well, this is not, like, weirdest hermaphrodite award.
Well, so luckily she's got the Skippy now, so...
So what you're saying is she should have been nominated for Worst Actor.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Maybe next year. If she's going the way you say she is, maybe next year. Fingers crossed, Dan. Next category then. Oh, it's a biggie. Worst Director.
Oh.
And the nominees are Kevin Smith, Tusk, Clint Eastwood, American Sniper, and Michael Bay, Transformers, Age of Extinction. And the Skippy goes to Clint Eastwood for American Sniper.
Thank you very much. It's quite overwhelming to... watch your career flash before your eyes. I think it's 43 years that I've been since I started out as an actor, and it's kind of like waking up with an orangutan, you know? You say, how did I get here? And a lot of you haven't awakened with orangutan, but I have.
Fully deserved.
Yeah. We've hinted at this already, but you can go and read my review of the film at skiptothend.co.uk. I hated it. Adam's seen it. He hated it. It's just a shit, terrible, horrible, pro-war, pro-American, right-wing nonsense film. And Clint Eastwood is an old master and should know better. He should hang his head in shame.
He should.
And the fact that he's had the nerve to say the film isn't political, well, clearly you don't understand what politics are then, mate, because it's very political.
He's actually come out and said it's the biggest anti-war statement a film's ever made.
Bollocks.
Which is complete toss.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, a very strong category this year. I mean, Michael Bay, again, is probably the thoroughbred horse.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, yeah. If the Skippies had existed prior to this year, he'd have a few. Yeah.
He would have a lot.
And I know that Ben would have nominated Kevin Smith more than once.
Yeah, I mean, it's only the fact that American Sniper was such a risible piece of shit that Smith didn't win, I think, because he is just a terrible, terrible director, isn't he, Mark?
He is not a terrible director, and he's made some absolute unbelievable pieces of work.
Not in the last 15 years.
But recently, he is deserved of this, because you can read my review of Tusk at skiptothend.co.uk, and at the moment, my love for him is on hiatus, because I'm not lying. He is... I'm worried. Very worried of that piece of shite he's made, but... Clint Eastwood, he's always had a place in my heart, and I'm absolutely mortified that he's made this piece of turd, because, you know, he's up there as a classic, really well-trained director who's been there and lived it, and to know that he's really offended you, Ben, in making this piece of tripe, good on him, because he's won himself a Skippy.
Yeah,
and I know
exactly.
That's the one thing he hasn't won yet.
It's definitely the award I think he wanted most.
Yeah.
So, now you've got it, Clint, you can go back to making good films again.
Good work.
We have two more awards to give away tonight. So, the next category is the worst film.
Ooh.
A big, big category, and I know that a lot of bets have been taken place on this. So, the nominees are Tusk, Sex Tape, Sin City 2, and the Skippy goes to Tusk.
Ooh.
Hey, it's Kevin Smith, man. I'm sorry I cannot be there, because I really wanted to be there. So I couldn't be there, so I'm bummed, but now even more bummed, because We won, man. You guys rock. I can't thank you enough.
That's an outside shot.
Wow. Kevin Smith, you've won something.
I wasn't expecting that, to be honest.
I
thought the field was very strong this year.
Yes, and if by strong you mean abysmally weak, you're absolutely right, yeah. Three of the worst films ever made, and I haven't even seen Tusk. Shouldn't have to. It's obvious. I've read Mark's review. I've read all the reviews. It sounds like one of the worst pieces of shit, and it purely strikes me that it's just because Kevin Smith has a level of fame and notoriety that he's allowed to do whatever he likes. There's no one reining him in, pulling him in, saying, why are you doing this, mate?
I wish they would.
Yeah.
Because there's a legacy there that he's just pissing all over.
I know, I mean, you know, Jersey Girl.
I think
the wonderful thing about this is the fact that Ben, if you hadn't noticed from the podcast, doesn't like Kevin Smith that much.
Not so much.
Not as a director. Mark absolutely loves him, although not so much at the minute. So to even have Mark sitting here agreeing that Tusk is the worst piece of shit he's seen this year is phenomenal for me.
Yeah, and this wasn't rigged. I didn't rig this.
No.
All the votes were tallied and sorted out by the guys from PricewaterhouseCoopers. We have independent adjudicators on this.
This is not just us three picking it out of a hat or anything like that.
No.
No, not at all. No.
So we have one final award to give away. This is the Lifetime Achievement Award for Terrible Movies. Now, the nominees are Lars von Trier, director known for The Idiots, Antichrist and Nymphomaniac. Kevin Smith, director known for Morats, Jersey Girl and Tusk. Kevin James, actor known for Paul Blart, Mall Cop, Grown Ups and the upcoming Paul Blart, Mall Cop 2. And the Skippy goes to Lars von Trier.
What can I say? I understand Hitler.
Whoa!
Calm down.
Strong words there, Lars. Wasn't expecting that at the Skippies this year.
Bit much.
Very much, if you don't mind me saying.
So, Lars, I think we can all agree that he's had an absolute pounding from us three on the podcast over 12 episodes. I don't think we've had one.
Fully deserved.
Yeah.
It wasn't... For me, the field this year, I mean, he was the outright winner.
Yeah.
There was... As much as, you know, Kevin Smith was in there, and Kevin James, who, let's face it, Paul Blart and Paul Blart Mall Cop 2, I think when the Sony hack happened and all the emails were leaked, the most offensive thing I read was that they were planning to release Paul Blart Mall Cop 2.
Yeah,
the fact that they're actually releasing it, rather than just abandon it after filming, which is what they should have done.
Sony hack.
The thing is, though, for the Kevins, Smith and James, don't worry, lads, you might not have won the Skippy this year, but it is a lifetime achievement.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so they could win it next year. You've got plenty of time. And listen, you're going to make more shit movies.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin Smith's doing Yoga Hoses, which is a spin-off of Kevin Smith's Tusk, which is turd enough. He's going to give us a spin-off.
And so I've just read a tweet that Paul Blart Mall Cop 3 is scheduled for next year, so look forward to
it. Don't give up, lads. You can win this award. But, Lars, you have made the worst films of all time. You have been an absolute arsehole on most of your interviews. You have just basically pissed a lot of people off. And we are very fair, and we always speak our hearts on this podcast. And, you know, some people are like, oh, God, isn't Foxcatcher an amazing film? We're going to say how it really is. We're not going to be bought and give it 10 out of 10 like other magazines. We are going to say what we think. And Lars von Trier, you have produced more turd than a sewer. You are literally a bellend, and you deserve this award. And I really, full-heartedly say you deserve every bit of respect that comes with this award.
Yeah.
I want you dead.
But thanks for coming to pick up your award tonight, lads. We appreciate it.
Tune in next year.
Well, no, tune in next time. Don't just leave it
here.
Our other shows are quite good as well.
Yeah.
But that brings us to a close of the first annual Skippy Awards.
Yeah.
How do we feel it's gone, lads?
Do you know what? It's been a sparkling gala event full of fun and festivities. You know, drinks were drunk, shenanigans were had, awards were given out. It's been a good night. It's been a good year.
And everyone is very happy with their skippies. I can see them all lining up now for photos. And Kevin Smith actually just told me that he's making yoga hoses in the hope that he wins the worst picture again next year.
I think he's got a fair shot.
Yeah.
Well done to all the winners, and thanks for listening.
This week's rewatch is the 1986 classic Aliens, sequel to the 1979 film Alien, surprisingly enough, written and directed by James Cameron, of course, starring Sigourney Weaver as Ripley. So let's get into it. Lads, what do you think?
Yeah, Aliens is a classic, by all accounts. It's not as good as the first one, in my opinion. I'm just going to start off there.
You're wrong.
But one of the things that I really hugely love about this sequel is that it's so different to the original.
Yeah.
To start with.
Different genres.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just one of the things. I mean, we talked about sequels and originals in the past and how they suffer from the law of diminishing returns and things like that. So when Cameron did do a sequel of Ridley Scott's original, he just went and basically tore up the book from the original and went, let's go out with a new focus on the actual species itself, which is fantastic. And it is one of those films in which it's kind of a slow burner to start with. And I love it for that. It's very much, they've got the motion trackers on the guns. You can hear them beep, beep. And yeah, eventually they find Newton. And then it takes a while for the aliens to start appearing.
It's over an hour before the aliens appear, yeah.
And that's, I think for me, that's one of the, I guess a little homage to Ridley Scott in a way. I mean, as much as it is an action film, they kind of leave it a while. And you don't really lose that sense of how the alien is a powerful creature. In the first one, we see that, and we see how, you know, it takes out most of the crew before anything can even happen to it, or you even see it, basically. Whereas in this, when you see them, that's when everything kicks off, I guess, really.
This is by far one of the greatest films ever made, and it's made in the 80s, of course it is. But on episode one, which you can listen to on iTunes, I brought this to the table as my one of my top five films of all time. So when you chose this last week, I could have easily give you a hand job to say thank you.
Cheers.
It's absolutely,
you did, didn't you?
Incredible.
That was just for a different reason.
This film, revisiting it again, and I haven't watched this for a few years. I remember they brought out a box set of the Blu-rays, and it was the first time it had been restored. And you know,
yeah,
it does look like it was filmed 5 or 6 years ago. I understand that films look dated, but this doesn't look like a film that was made in the mid-80s. The special effects and the directing and the cinematography is textbook for me. There's nothing that gets close to this around the time of this was made. I can't believe it's that old, and I still, right now, will say that James Cameron's ideas were way above anything at the time. Mm-hmm. He made this film, and people use this too often, but it is a masterpiece. The way he's filmed it, and the suspense, and the way the aliens are all controlled, the even just the action, the flamethrower, everything about it is glorious. It really is.
Here's a question then, because you mentioned earlier that you disagree with Adam when Adam says the first one's better. Why is that? You disagree with that, so you think this one's better than Alien. Why is that? And the reason why I ask is because when I said that they're different genres, to me this is an action film. It's a sort of war film. You know, it's like other. You might see a film like Platoon or something like that. Whereas Alien was a horror film.
Yeah,
horror's your bag. So it's surprising to me that this is your preference.
And I think the whole package is you get this action film, like you said. There's more to it.
But there are horror elements in there as well.
It's just got everything. I felt like I was watching an action film at times, and the battle at the end for me, against the Queen versus Ripley,
which is in the actual suit. Yeah,
and just everything about it—the way that the story continues. I'm more into the characters. I needed Alien to fall in love with the film, get to know Ripley, get to see Hicks, and then to see this film then go further, and we even get the story continued. It delivered, where a lot of sequels just don't deliver. So for me, Aliens had more of an enjoyment factor. I will go back to Aliens more.
Yeah.
Alien is a standout kind of horror movie which ticks every box, but this just does everything extra. It's,
I mean,
good question, Ben.
20 years Cheers. Next year since this came out. 30 years.
Yeah. Frightening.
And yeah, it doesn't look 30 years old. And I'll tell you what, one of the things that always stands out for this film, for me, and the one before this, is just how much of a kick-ass female character Ripley is, Sigourney Weaver is. There have been great kick-ass female characters over the years. You know, look at Uma Thurman in the Kill Bill films, or you look at Linda Hamilton and Sarah Connor in Terminator 2, especially another James Cameron film. But I don't think there is a better kick-ass female character in film than Ripley.
No, I agree with that as well. And, I mean, We talked about the action elements of it as well, but this film does kind of mesh together, as I said, the horror and action elements. I mean, there's the bit where they realise that all of the colonists are gathered in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
So they go to find them, and they end up walking through the alien hive.
Yeah.
And then they find them all in the walls. I mean, that's when you first see that, you're just mesmerised by the entire scene. Because at this point, we haven't really been introduced to the alien queen.
No.
So we don't really we have this view of them in these eggs from the first film, but we have no idea where these eggs came from. We have no idea about any of that. So to actually see that this planet is now live, I guess, you know, we actually have an alien hive there again. It's not just the eggs that were left for years and years and years in stasis. We actually have a hive again. So we actually see why they're so devastating. The fact that they, you know, they start out as these little face huggers and then they basically take you and turn you into their weapon because they gestate within you.
Yeah.
And I just think that was a fascinating thing. And one of the best things about the alien mythology came in this film, which was we finally got to see how, you know, an egg going to a planet can devastate one planet.
Yeah. The sheer power.
Yeah.
It's harrowing, that scene, because you see one of the eggs, don't you? And then the shot turns to the left and you literally see 50, 60 eggs.
Yeah.
And she's standing there in the middle of it all. And you just literally, your heart just stops. You're like, oh my God. But one thing that I really liked, and I only picked up on it again, is when you see the egg first hatch. And it kind of opens like, it reminds me of like Little Shop of Horrors, you know, the mouth.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But it looks so good. And that's one of the things with these films, that nothing looked terrible now. If you go back and watch even stuff like, you know, I love Gremlins. You watch it now and it looks stupid. You know it's puppets. You know it is ridiculous. A lot of these films from the 80s now just have really aged. Everything in this film looks still perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, the Queen Alien looks amazing.
Yeah, she does.
I think it took 16 people to operate that, by the way, which is frightening.
I was just going to say, I mean, now obviously, when we've spoke about it before on the podcast about how there is an over-reliance on CGI at the moment.
Yeah.
And films like this that look timeless prove that. I mean, the animatronics used involved, even in the first Alien film, the animatronics on how they design the face of a creature is superb.
Yeah, and the chest burster.
Yeah, and the chest.
Oh, it looks amazing.
I mean, they just this film kind of proves you don't need CGI.
Yeah, and you think now, that was animatronics from 29 years ago.
Surely they've come up.
Surely now they're so good that we don't need to rely on CGI. We can do things that are damn near real life without having to rely on computers. Because you can always tell the difference. I mean, we've had this conversation before when we talked about Phantom Menace. You'll see certain characters that were obviously rubber suits, and they look so much better than when you see Watto, who's clearly computer generated. They just don't look the same, and one looks notably better than the other. So there's no excuse for films relying on CGI as much as they do, especially when you can look at the... It is lazy. Especially when you can look at this and see how good a film can be without it.
I think what the difference is James Cameron puts his heart into the film, and you know that every scene and every... Even the costumes that they're wearing, you know, the uniforms and the detail in every little thing, you know he's not just cut any corners, and you can see how much effort and heart goes into these films, and you know, look at the actual spacecraft and stuff, and then how good do they look?
Yeah.
And you know, some of it is a toy, you know, so it's a figure, and but it looks good. You know, there's films now that look terrible when they do this, and he was doing it 30 years ago. And I remember that I was watching it and he's flying, the craft's flying off into obviously space. It looked bloody awesome. It looked like they were Star Wars. It was great.
I feel we should be a bit cautious when praising James Cameron for his lack of CGI usage.
Yeah, he
gave birth to Avatar.
Before Avatar, this guy never cut corners. Now it's all green screen.
He actually did drown, I think, 6,000 people in Titanic. Yeah, that was real.
That's how realistic that was. Yeah. It's the animatronics. But Aliens, I mean, just the effects, everything about it, man. And obviously there's memorable scenes in it as well. Like, I mean, much like in Alien 1, the memorable scenes, I've got to stop calling it Alien 1, it's Alien and Aliens. The effects, the memorable moments in Aliens, I mean, obviously when they're all in the ceiling, and they realise, he's like, I've got motion, mm-hmm. I've got motion. Where are they? They're in the room. And then you realise, fuck.
A famous scene for me as well, it's not even involving any aliens, the knife scene with the hand. Just tense, just sitting there watching that again and, you know, brilliant. Just a really iconic scene that you forget.
Lance Henriksen was quite kind of an unshun hero in this, isn't he, really?
Unsung hero,
as Bishop.
Yeah, I love him as Bishop. I love the scene at the end when he gets ripped in half by the Queen. And
that's
he still
amazing.
Manages to save him.
Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah.
And that again, if you listen to this, go back and do the same. Watch Aliens again, because you forget how good that looks. It literally just rips him as if it's you just grabbing a piece of paper and ripping it. It is horrendous.
Yeah.
And then obviously all of his weird white blood is just disgusting. It starts... Oh,
these are the memorable scenes. And this is what kind of makes films stand out. Because how many times you see a sci-fi film now or an action film now that you can't recall a lot of it by the end of it?
Because they're identical now. They're all it's just the same thing every day. One of the things that made me chuckle a bit was I was watching this and when they first hired the Marines to go up to the planet... One of them said, so what are we doing here? What is this? Is this a bug hunt? And when I heard him use that term bug hunt, it made me think of Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, that's I'm sure they use it in Starship Troopers. They must have got it from that, because obviously Starship Troopers came out something like 12 years later. But what it was is that I didn't know that Starship Troopers was from a novel, and that term bug hunt is from the novel, which is from before Aliens. And basically, apparently, James Cameron gave that book to a lot of the cast and said, read Starship Troopers, that's what
this
we're going for.
Yeah, this is what we're looking at.
I might check that out. That sounds quite a good read.
I love the film Starship Troopers. I might do that as a rewatch one day.
Sigourney Weaver. Let's talk Sigourney Weaver. So we've mentioned that obviously she led the film as a female, and it was one of the iconic. We probably can't think of a better performance. That film with her is outstanding. The emotion she shows, you relate to. You sit, you don't relate. You're not. Oh yeah, I've been in a ship with an alien before.
Thanks for having a go at me.
Wow, and the love she has when she meets Newt and kind of takes her under her wing. Mm. The mother-daughter bond is there. Obviously, it's not her daughter, but to see that kind of bond that she has, then an hour later be trying to rip her alien apart for attacking them is amazing.
Well, one of the things that Adam spoke about earlier in the show was that comic book movies don't really get the play they deserve at the Oscars, and that's true of sci-fi films.
Yeah,
more
definitely.
Often than not, sci-fi films, no matter how good they are, get overlooked. You know, Blade Runner certainly did. But Sigourney Weaver was nominated for Best Actress for this, which is a phenomenal achievement and, you know, fully deserved.
There are, obviously, exceptions that prove the rule all the time. I mean, James Cameron was nominated Best Director, I think, for Avatar. I mean, how much direction went into that, I'm not really sure, if I'm honest. But there are exceptions. Sigourney Weaver, I mean, I don't think anyone can complain with that.
No, certainly not. Great performance.
I also really rate Bill Paxton's Hudson, you know. What a great character, you know. I read a lot of his lines were actually improvised, so they let him just get on with it.
I recently started watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and he appears in, as Garrett.
Yeah.
And he plays a very kind of, not similar character, but it's another soldier. And he did get a bit typecast, I imagine.
He did, because the year before this came out, in 1985, Weird Science came out. And he played the older brother, Chet, in Weird Science. And in that, I think he was a military man. In that, and he was like an arrogant douche as well. That was his role in the mid-80s, I think. And he's very good at it.
He did actually say fuck in that film as well 18 times, which is a shame.
That's nearly as many times as we say it on this show.
Cheapens it. Shame that.
But I think one of the interesting things about the Alien and Aliens films is that Alien, although it's kind of the title character, isn't necessarily the evil thing. It's not, you know, it's just doing what it was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
we have characters like Burke, who are quintessentially the evil character.
Yeah.
Played by Paul Reiser.
Paul Reiser, right?
Bit
again.
Of a Paul Reiser special. This one.
Episode 13. Well. Paul Reiser special.
So, I mean, that's one of the interesting. We have the android in Alien.
Yeah.
Which obviously contributes, to Ripley's distrust of Bishop.
Ash.
Ripley's distrust of Bishop throughout the entire of Aliens.
Yeah.
So again, it's just that thing about the alien is obviously the killing machine. It's the big creature, but actually, it's not necessarily the alien that's doing the evil stuff. It's they wouldn't be there without Weyland-Yutani.
Who's your favourite Weyland-Yutani android? Is it Ash from Alien, Bishop from Aliens, or David from Prometheus?
Ah, that's difficult.
Bishop's classic, but David, Michael Fassbender, is so good in Prometheus. I think David might be my favourite.
Weyland-Yutani.
I'm going Ash,
android.
Just to be different.
I'll go Bishop then.
Yeah, one of each.
What was quite crazy, which I was obviously researching this film afterwards, is that I didn't realise that James Cameron, obviously, while he was writing the screenplay, then went off to do the actual production for Terminator.
Mm.
They agreed to actually wait, so 20th Century Fox actually waited for him to come available again so he'd return. So that's pretty crazy that he only got 90 pages into it before saying, actually, I've got another commitment, I'll be back.
Yeah. And they nice.
Thank you.
They read the 90 pages.
Yeah.
And they could have let him go and got someone else to do it, but they liked what they read so much that they didn't want to lose him.
But that to me now sums up the difference between then and now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because nowadays they're not willing to wait. Studios don't want to wait. They want to get their film out, even if it's a subpar film.
They'd have done an Ant-Man and sacked him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Providing they know they're going to get X amount of dollars just for releasing a film. They don't care how it ends. They don't care if James Cameron writes the full script or 30% of it.
Yeah, Hollywood's a different animal altogether these days.
Whereas back then, they were actually in it to make good films.
Yeah, they gave them the time. I mean, this film wasn't finished editing until a week before its cinema release, so they never even showed it to test audiences. Mm-hmm. Now, if the test audience didn't all go, oh, it's the best film ever made, they won't release it, or it'll get put back and put back. Look what happened. Don't give them a test audience. They know they've made an actual gem of a film.
Don't test anything.
No,
just put it out.
Yeah.
Parachutes, don't test them, just put them out. But yeah, this film, Ben, I was so chuffed that you chose it because it's one of my favourites. Uh-huh. It was great to revisit it. Considering I always talk about it, it probably has been 3 or 4 years since I watched it. Did you guys ever see the director's cut? Because obviously he's very big on releasing the film. Mm-hmm. Do you believe it's one of those films that you need to see the director's cut?
No.
I don't.
Probably not.
Nah. Do you know the actual 15-minute countdown as well at the end of the film is actually 15 minutes exactly?
And I read that before I actually rewatched the film, so the sad sod that I am timed it out, and it is spot on.
That's the detail that's he goes to.
But he's been known to do that, Cameron. He does go into a lot of depth in his films. He's not just going to rush through something and get it out. I mean, if we look at the actors, I mean, he's very good at using similar actors. But I think Michael Biehn's actually in Terminator.
Yeah,
as Carl Reese, isn't he? So he obviously liked him that much that he wanted to bring him in for it.
I think what makes the film overall for me is the set design as well.
Mm-hmm.
Again, let's be honest about it. This film made right now, if you ever remake it, I'll find out who you are and I'll kill you. But if they ever remake this film, come on, man, you know what they do now. Featuring Michael Bay. It'd be dreadful.
The alien would have an offensive West Indian accent.
It's true, but did you know that they actually kept the set as well after filming? The alien nest set? They actually kept that and they used it in Batman.
Which
this
one?
Is no
the,
truth.
The
in the
first
original 1989, they used it later for the Axis chemical set.
Nice.
So, recycled.
Recycling it.
But no, that's the sort of thing that makes it. That's why I like John Carpenter films. That's why I like all this. They make the sets. They don't just rely on a green screen,
Yeah.
Fair play to the guys.
Totally agree. Well, great rewatch there, Ben.
Yeah. It was, yeah.
It was.
Scores on the doors, then.
See, this is a difficult one. So we just obviously talked about Whiplash and no film can get a 10.
Yeah.
If I was to now see this film and rate it, I would want to give it a 10 because it's one of my favourite films of all time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it a 10.
Okay.
But it won't make any difference because with our scoring, unless one of you say 10, which you won't, it makes jack shit.
Yeah.
I'm a 9. It is a film that has stood the test of time for me. So It gets that high praise. But Alien is a 10 for me.
Okay.
Aliens is a 9.
It gets an 8 for me, purely because I don't like how long it takes for it to get into high gear. I think the first hour was fine, but I just wish they'd have got to the meat of the story a bit quicker.
You're very much it's an action film, not a horror film, aren't you? With Alien, you're happy that it takes a while to build and slow burn, I imagine. But because this is billed to you as an action film, you have to.
You know, if you're going to bring in some space marines, let's have them up there shooting shit within the first 3-4 minutes for me.
But the reward you get when they finally come.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent film. It's just a bit slow to get started. So that, you know, an 8 is still a damn high score.
It is.
So that gives it an overall skip to the end rewatch score of 9 out of 10.
Wow. Ooh. 2 9s in one episode.
Jeez.
So
we've been spoiled.
Pressure's on.
Mm-hmm.
Next rewatch.
Right, guys, we're going to watch a film that's 20 years old.
Okay.
Do any of you want to have any guesses what I'm going to pick?
20 years old, so that's what? 95?
Yeah. Well, probably 94, 95, yeah.
Pulp Fiction.
Nope. Adam, you've got one guess. What's Mark going to put out the bag?
I'm trying to think what was made in 94 or 95.
Dumb and Dumber.
Damn it!
Is it Dumb and Dumber?
No.
Thank God for that.
Next week's rewatch is going to be The Crow.
Nice! Oh, I'm chuffed with that because it's one of those that I've been meaning to rewatch for ages and haven't. Because
yeah.
I used to have it on VHS and I used to just watch that shit every week. Loved it.
It started off all these sort of films. It was the first of a kind. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we lost Brandon Lee because of it, but a film I've not watched for years, and I just think it could be really good to revisit
definitely.
Again.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, love awesome. This film.
Next week, guys, The Crow. Your favourite time, boys? Listener questions.
Yay.
I do love listener questions.
I do. As long as they're good questions.
I like interacting with our listeners, just from a safe distance.
We've had a lot of new people as well, like I said earlier on Twitter, which is @STTEPodcast. It seems to be getting a lot of response at the moment. A lot of people are interacting, and just keep these questions coming. We'll make sure we answer every single one of them. First of all, we had Stu Pickering come through, and he basically wants to know, who's your most inconsistent actors?
Ooh, that's a good one.
So those actors who turn in great performances, but then are capable of turning in absolutely shit performances as well.
Yeah, like Arlo would say, they produce dog turd.
I think two for me, actually, I've got two that I can think of, are two of the greatest actors of all time, De Niro and Pacino. They started their careers brilliantly with these powerful bits of work that they were nominated for Oscars. Then they had these fallow periods of their career where they've just done absolute shit for paychecks. And I think Pacino is still in that. De Niro seems to be coming out the other side of it now, doing good work again. But it's not inconsistent as in good film, bad film, good film, bad film. It's like good decade, bad decade. So I would say Pacino and De Niro for me.
Adam,
good shout, very good shout. You could say Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's a very similar situation. He had a great 10 years from like 1994 to about 2004, 2005, and then he's just gone crap again.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Jim Carrey.
Ben Stiller, again, is another one I would say. I think he has the ability to be both one of the funniest comedic actors and one of the most annoying.
Steve Carell?
I would only say we're just hindered by Foxcatcher at the minute. I don't think we should tar him.
And to be fair, it's a very good performance, as Mr. Burns, as we said.
Yeah.
My choice will be Jeff Daniels.
because he's
been very bad. But overall, it's not inconsistent as being good and bad. It's inconsistent on the amount of dog shit he produces. So it's little bits of shit, very shit, and really, really shit. And that's
Smith.
Keanu Reeves.
Not Kevin Smith, then.
Keanu Reeves. Yeah. He can deliver so many different sort of styles of dog shit acting. It's a
massive... not emotions.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. He has got an array of dog shit, but no human emotions.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing John Wick, though. That's meant to be quite good when that comes out.
Yeah, and I'll definitely review that, because I've ordered it from America. It's out on Blu-ray now.
Oh, cool.
So I'm definitely going to watch that. It's supposed to be really good, and he actually acts in it.
Yeah.
The next question is from Ian Young, which is @IanYoungCop on Twitter. Films that you loved as a child and you still love now?
Probably Star Wars.
Yeah, I think that's an obvious one, yeah. I'd say Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, as a kid.
But I looked at it as a cartoon because, you know, it's partially a cartoon. But now when you see it as an adult, you realise that it's a far darker thing than you remember it to be. It was
definitely. Probably, again, just stuff like Aladdin as well, Lion King, you know, Hercules, things that I watched as a kid.
You love to get Aladdin, don't you?
I'm going to go with the Police Academy films. Yeah, I used to watch them as a kid. Really stupid. Sometimes on ITV2 and other channels. And if they're on, I still just about laugh.
Mission to Moscow?
It's the only title that no one ever remembers.
No, so it's Back in Patrol, training, I remember. Back in Training.
Yeah.
Next question. Can you name all seven Police Academy? No. next question. At TXV Addict, we've had questions similar to this, but it's a bit different.
Brilliant.
After reading your articles recently on what you should be watching, is there a TV series that you only want one more series to be added?
So one that we think is pretty much about ready to end?
Yeah, you could just have... Or there's one series out there that you wish they'd just done one more to finish it off, or one more... Like Heroes stopped, didn't it?
Yeah, good. Not too soon. Yeah. Yeah, that should have only done one season.
Yeah,
the rest of it was garbage.
I think it's not that I only want one more, but just please give us one more of Constantine. Yeah. It's not been renewed yet. Just I'll take one more at this stage.
I would have loved another season of Seinfeld.
Yeah,
Jerry Seinfeld just said that he didn't want to do it anymore. That they, you know, the network NBC wanted them to continue, and I think it was as good in the final season as it was in at the start. So I would have loved to have seen another year of Seinfeld.
So. I'll go with Spaced. When it ended on series 2, it was great, but it just left me wanting more.
Well, speaking of Seinfeld, obviously Larry David was one of the co-creators. I'd love to see another season of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Is it a series that has to be running now?
No. What's the TV series that you'd like to see one more series of?
Okay. No, yeah, probably, I mean, stuff like, say, Constantine.
Yeah.
At this stage, it looks like it's probably going to end at season 1.
Mm.
I don't think, it looks like it's probably not going to get renewed, but I'd love to see an extra series of it.
I've not seen it, but after reading your skiptotheend.co.uk article on why I should be watching it, I'm going to.
And I think if it gets one more season, it'll get another.
Yeah.
I think once it builds, it's like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. The competition winner from last week, at BlameFerrer83, has given us a very good question
Where's my gift?
Yeah, yeah, I'm still waiting. Your least favourite film trend, e.g. Post-Lockstock gave us shit British crime flicks.
That's a good question, actually.
Yeah, rom-coms, all of them.
Yeah.
Shit.
Vampires.
I hate zombies.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of zombies.
But there are so many piss-poor zombie films that you're hard-pressed to find good ones in the morass of bad ones.
I think that's a fair comment. You have to kind of go quite far out now. I mean, we've seen Dawn of the Dead remakes and things like that, which, but, I mean, stuff like Dead Snow.
I've not seen that. Is that the Nazi?
Nazi zombies. It's a Norwegian film, brilliant.
Going back to your vampires point, actually, I'd like to sort of bring that down and be more specific. Prior to Interview with a Vampire, vampires were evil murderers. Then Interview with a Vampire book came out, film was made of it, and then all of a sudden, vampires are emo. And all vampire films that have come since, it's always emo vampires.
Except Blade,
yeah.
More Blade.
I hated that trend of, and it still keeps going now, when they just do the spoofs, like Scary Movie and I Still Know What You're Doing Last Summer, Halloween, all this bollocks. Yeah. You know, there's so many of them that they're cashing in on at the moment where they try and be funny. And
Disney
they're just not.
High school singing shite.
Yeah. Terrible.
Yeah, but would that have given us Beverly Hills Chihuahua?
Fair enough.
There is a singing scene in that.
You'd know.
Yeah, it's a great film. And the final question from Phil Downs. Who would be the one person that you least want to interview, movie-related? So you have to interview him. There's no choice. You've got to go in the room with them and actually interview them.
Kevin Smith. Because I'd have to pretend to give a shit about any of his work, wouldn't I?
No, because you could interview him about, you know, how shit he is.
Yeah, how many burgers he eats.
I'd like to least interview Lars von Trier.
See, I wouldn't mind interviewing Lars, because I probably would just spend the interview telling him I thought it was dreadful.
Mm.
Yeah.
See, there are some people that, in principle, I don't think I'd want to interview, because they're just known to be dicks, but I think they'd be fun in that. Like Russell Crowe, for example.
Yeah.
I think he'd be so confrontational that you could just wind him up so easily.
Yeah. Your choice. Least like to interview?
Probably Keanu Reeves.
Do you reckon he'd be as boring and wooden in real life as he is in film?
I think he would be.
Yeah.
Like we sound right now. It's a question. Keep your questions coming in. You can email us at skiptotheend@icloud.com. You can also go on Facebook, which is facebook.com/skiptotheendpodcast. or go on Twitter, which seems to be the most popular, at STTE Podcast. And if you don't want to send us a question in but want to see some cool pictures, skip to the end podcast on Instagram right now for very cool images and also links to all our articles, which we publish daily on skiptheend.co.uk.
So that brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Skip to the End podcast. It's been all right, isn't it, lads?
Yeah, it's been good. I've enjoyed it.
Excellent. Next time around, we're going to be reviewing the new Paul Thomas Anderson film, Inherent Vice. I particularly am very excited for this.
Yeah, me too.
He was my number one director in a previous list that we did a few weeks back.
I think we're all in agreement that Joaquin Phoenix is a fantastic actor, so looking to see those two get together.
Speaking of lists, what are we going to be doing next time, Adam?
The top three acting performances that should have been nominated for an Oscar and weren't. And you have to replace one person that was nominated that year with them.
Okay. And we're also going to have a rewatch. What are we going to rewatch, Mark?
Well, we're going to go back 20 years and watch The Crow. So I think we'll be excited about that.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. We're also going to have our final Oscar predictions because it'll be our last show before the Oscars are actually announced. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So we shall speak to you then.